I'm Robert Castanello, an assistant professor of history at the University of Central Florida, and you are listening to the Riches Documentary Podcast. This episode was produced by Jeffrey Caviero and is the second of a two-part episode that features an interview he conducted with the historian Paul Ortiz at the University of Florida. The interview is related to the research he conducted in his book, Emancipation Betrayed.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey Caviero, and in today's podcast, we're going to continue our discussion with Dr. Paul Ortiz, who is an associate professor at the University of Florida, as well as their director of the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program. The program has been around since 1967, collecting over 5,000 oral history interviews from Floridians across the state. In this second part of a two-part interview, Dr. Ortiz continues to discuss the Florida voter registration movement of 1919 to 1920, and the role that African Americans in Central Florida may have played in it.
In 1919, there were still African Americans who participated in politics as far back as Reconstruction. And to me, one of the most exciting things about Emancipation Betrayed in doing the research for the book was finding some of these individuals, not all of them, but a few of them. I mean, people like M.M. Louie, who was a combat veteran in the Civil War, who was involved in the Pensacola streetcar boycott in 1901, 1905, and then seeing him come up in 1919, and now he's teaching people how to register to vote. He's teaching African-American history. And in Central Florida, the power of black secret societies was quite impressive. And you had very strong black fraternal organizations in Tampa, in Lakeland, in Orlando. African Americans used these fraternal organizations to organize, in part because there were no white people there to watch what they were doing. You know, you had white Masons, you had black Masons, you had white Knights of Pythians, you had black Knights of Pythians. And the lodge, maybe even more so than the church, was a much more secure place to organize because, again, there were a few prying eyes around there. And so there were a series of statewide black fraternal secret society meetings that occurred, one of them in Tampa, 1919-1920, where the Knights of Pythias met. And at that convention, it was decided, and this was by universal acclamation, and reading the minutes of this meeting are quite startling because what the members say is that from here on out, to be a member of this organization, to stay in good standing in this organization, you have to pay your poll taxes and you have to register to vote, which is pretty startling if you think about it. This is 1919, and there are many parts, many places where you can be shot for doing this, but yet these men and the Knights of Pythias took this pledge, and they made it into an oath. And they said, from here on out, and they gave people a certain time period to do this in, but they said, when we finish this convention, the first thing our members need to do is go back to their home counties throughout Florida, pay their poll taxes, register to vote, to remain in good standing in the order. What it meant to be in bad standing, if you got kicked out of the order, then you lost your access to workman's compensation, widow's death benefits, and social insurance. Because back before the Great Depression, there was no unemployment. You know, there was no Social Security. And so that's why African Americans joined these organizations. That's why first-generation European immigrants joined these organizations. Because when you put you paid your dime or quarter per month into your fraternal organization, that was your social insurance. So if you died, if you got killed on the job, and many African Americans did, because they worked in the most dangerous occupations in the state, and they were members in good standing, their surviving family members would receive a death benefit. And that death benefit was the difference between being able to afford a decent burial and having some money for your family versus having to beg on your knees to the boss, you know, for a pine coffin, you know. And so being a member in good standing in your in your secret society or in your law. The Great Depression really took a major toll on those organizations because, as you can imagine, they're the first organizations that, when the Depression hit, people went to for social insurance, and so very quickly a lot of them kind of went under. But the other thing that happened in 1919 was that women gained the right to vote. And this is enormous because African-American women began organizing long before the 19th Amendment is ratified. They know that the 19th Amendment is going to be ratified in time for the general election. And black women have an advantage that men don't have in 1920, which is they've never been eligible to vote before, so hence they don't have to pay any back poll taxes. So they can go and actually register to vote, and that's it. They don't have to pay a poll tax. The other advantage they have, which is key, is they also have their own secret society organizations, and they're often counterparts to the male organizations. And so, there's the Masons for the men, there's the Daughters of Eastern Star for the women. There's the Knights of Pythias for the men, there's the Courts of Calantha for the women. So they have their own secret societies. They have their own fraternal, sororal organizations, I should say. Sometimes they have their own labor unions. And so you see both men and women organizing, but in some ways, women take the leadership. African-American women take the leadership in these organizing campaigns. People like, Mrs. Bethune, Bethune College in Daytona, become statewide leaders because, again, African-American women have statewide organizations. They have the State Federation of Women's Clubs, a black women's clubs, a statewide organization, chapters in Orlando, chapters in Barstow, all across what we call now the I-4 corridor, is very strong in terms of organization. And Tampa, St. Pete, women are highly organized, and so they're ready. The drama of the 19th Amendment, of course, is that, as we know now, it was passed on the eve of the 1920 election. The day after it's passed, we have documentary evidence that hundreds of black women in each of these towns, Orlando, Gainesville, Pensacola, St. Pete, show up to register to vote in groups, not as individuals, but in their organizations. In their church organizations, in their sororal organizations, in their labor organizations, women come in mass. And it stuns the state authorities because now the ruling elite in Florida see the writing on the wall. They see that, oh my gosh, our whole system of Jim Crow is in jeopardy, or this, what they call the system of white supremacy, was in terrible jeopardy. And now the kind of the final dimension is that the national organizations look at Florida, and organizations like the NAACP, and they say, well, maybe this is it. Florida looks to be our main chance to end this system of white supremacy and segregation. And the NAACP gets involved. And a big advantage for Florida is that there, at that time, the person who's operating really is the field secretary of the organization of the NAACP is James Weldon Johnson. He's a native son of Florida. And one of the early first NAACP chapters that's formed here is in Jacksonville, his hometown. And James Weldon Johnson uses Florida as a base of operation to come into the South, because at that point he's been living in New York for several years, and get the NAACP organized for the first time ever as a mass organization. Before this time, the NAACP was a very important organization, but in some ways very small, very kind of limited in its political influence. But so many things are happening during this period of time. One is that African Americans are moving in large numbers into the North. And so now they're able to join NAACP chapters in New York and Chicago and Detroit, other places. And when Johnson comes south, he comes into Florida, and he tells African-American communities and groups, I know you have your statewide and regional and city organizations, but I'm asking you to join forces with a national organization because it will magnify our power. And our issues are your issues. Educational equality, an end to lynching, an end to debt peonage, an end to the convict lease, and regaining our right to vote. Those are the core issues of the organization. And so there's all of this drama which is occurring because people are looking to Florida all across the country and saying, maybe this is it for this system of oppression. Because if you regain the right to vote, then it's almost like a domino effect. Because if you now can vote, you haven't won the whole thing, but it's a critical component of ending the system of inequality. You can't even begin to address inequality unless you have the right to vote. And that's the crux of what African Americans mobilized around in 1919, 1920. So there, you know, there's a regional, there's a state, in a national and international context, because I think the war, the Great War, as they called it then, as we call it now, World War I, had a huge impact on what was happening. When we look at African-American history between the end of Reconstruction and the Great Depression, we'll find a lot of surprises. And what I'd like to emphasize is that my research and the research that many outstanding scholars are doing now on Florida is really only the beginning. And we have barely, I feel like my work has just skimmed the surface, really, that I'm hoping that we can really encourage at UCF, at UF, at other universities and museums, nonprofit organizations as well. I'm hoping we can really encourage a renaissance or a resurgence in African American history. I mean, I see this happening. But I hope that we can continue to spur interest and, you know, get graduate students excited about studying Florida topics, because so much of the important work that needs to be done has not been done. We need to I make the argument here at UF every day, we need to really encourage our undergraduates, our grad students, our high school students, our teachers to study Florida. History is in our own backyard. I mean, there are individuals who we need to interview now. I mean, if you're listening to this and you're interested in these topics, chances are there are people in your own neighborhood or in your own town who can tell you stories about the Civil Rights Movement era or even further back. And this is one of the wonderful things about oral history, is it's very democratic and a small d democratic, and it allows us to really get to the root of our experiences. And I guess the last thing I'd add is we have to study history in all of its facets, and not just when we like the outcomes. I mean, the outcome of the 1920 election was a terrible tragedy. And I try to make the argument in the book, it wasn't just a tragedy for African Americans in Florida, although first and foremost, it was a terrible tragedy. I mean, many African Americans were killed, were murdered. Central Florida, Orlando, there was a terrible pogrom that occurred in the city of Ocoee. I was invited to give the MLK keynote address there last year, and we reflected on this horrific pogrom that occurred on election day. You know, again, hundreds of African Americans driven out of their community in western Orange County because they tried to vote. And the residents there are beginning to really seriously now face up to history and to say that let's learn from some of these other communities like Birmingham or Memphis. You know, for years, people in Memphis and Birmingham tried to sweep the movement under the rug. And then at a certain point, they realized that telling the story and respecting different stories actually makes a lot of sense. Birmingham has a wonderful civil rights museum. Memphis has a wonderful civil rights museum. My question is, why not Florida? We should have four or five of them. I think there should be a civil rights museum in Orlando. I think there should be a major civil rights museum in Tampa. I think there should be a major civil rights city museum in St. Augustine and other places, because you will not find another state in the United States where African Americans and their allies have fought longer and harder for freedom. Florida is it. If you talk about Harry T. Moore and Harriet Moore in Brevard County, civil rights pioneers, they led a statewide voter registration movement after World War II. They were assassinated for doing that long before the Montgomery bus boycott, you know, before the student sit-ins of the 60s. You had the Moors in Brevard County, you know, and to me, these are, you know, sometimes people say, well, Paul, you know, that's kind of tragic history. I'd rather kind of stay away from that. My response is, history does involve tragedies. It involves triumphs. And we need to study both, you know, equally and to try to learn from them. And that's, if you're looking for role models and on how people get things done, even under oppressive situations, and can create, you know, political movements for freedom, who can create great literature under duress, Florida is the place. You know, Zora Neale Hurston, A. Philip Randolph, Reverend Howard Thurman, James Weldon Johnson. You know, the list just goes on and on and on. And I mean, my argument is that the state, African-American communities have produced so many world historic figures. Mrs. Mary McLeod Bethune is another person who comes to mind. You know, Jeanetta Cole, her family came out of Jacksonville. And so I think we're just at a point, we're just in some ways getting started on this history. I'm really glad your program is working on it. And I think we just need to continue to work. We'll find some really exciting stories.
We'd like to thank Dr. Ortiz for joining our discussion. If you'd like to learn more about the African-American struggle in Florida, look for his book, Emancipation Betrayed, The Hidden History of Black Organizing and White Violence in Florida, from Reconstruction to the Bloody Election of 1920. I'm Jeffrey Crivera. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for listening to The Riches Podcast. And don't forget to join us in March of 2013 when we launch our new podcast series.